Shalom Harabarnix. Welcome to our next session in the in our class, the first regathering, Zionism and Modern Israel. We are in session 8, dealing with the rise of Zionism. So let's review where we have been in the last few sessions. Last session we saw that Theodor Herzl published Der Judenstaat, which caused the Zionist movement to be communicated to European Jews in a very forceful way in a language that they were used to hearing. Then that precipitated the first Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland in 1897. Herzl was elected president of this first Zionist organization. They had devised a four-step plan to support the reinstitution of the land of Israel. Herzl had even provided an anthem. He knew that a country needed a national anthem, and you can listen to Hatikva, which is the Israeli national anthem, at this address. He also knew that a new country needed a flag, and this is a sketch in Herzl's diary for a proposed flag for the Zionist movement. This was the original flag that was designed, and this is the final design that we have today, the flag of the country of Israel. Then he wrote in his diary, privately, he said, "If I were to sum up the Basel Conference in a single phrase, which I would dare not make public, I would say, in Basel, I created the Jewish state." And that statement bothers me. It's a statement, I think, tinged with arrogance, because he's ignoring the work of all the others who had gone before him, starting the Chovev Yitzion groups and the Bilum, etc., and the Bilu groups, you know, the kibbutz movement, the forerunners of the kibbutz movement, all that went on before him. And that also he usurps the glory of God in that statement. Well, the Second Zionist Congress meant the next year. Here is Herzl at the podium. Herzl realized that he needed Germany's support in order to have the Ottoman Emperor, the Ottoman Empire, approve a Jewish enclave in their midst. So he went to Kaiser Wilhelm II, who was initially open to it, but as soon as he found out the Ottomans were not interested, he dropped the Zionists. The Third Zionist Congress, the Jewish Colonial Trust Fund Bank, was established to deal with the funds needed for the new country. In the Fourth Zionist Congress, things were moving very slowly and very poorly. In 1901, Herzl wrote in his diary, "The wind blows through the stubble. I feel my autumn approaching. I see before me the danger of leaving no achievement in the world and inheritance for my children." During the Fifth Zionist Congress, the Jewish National Fund was established. In 1902, the Misraki was founded. And so Zionism from 1901 to 1903 was kind of in the doldrums. Then British Colonial Secretary had an interview with Herzl. And Herzl suggested two possible temporary homes for the Jewish people, one being, here's Israel, one being Cyprus in the Mediterranean to the north, and the other possibility being Al-Arish at the northern end of the Sinai Peninsula. Both of these were rejected. During this time of flagging morale, Herzl dashed off Alt-Nuland, and then in 1903, when he returned and talked with Chamberlain suggested, well, what about East Africa? Well, here was Israel. East Africa is located way down on the eastern coast of Africa. This is British East Africa, or the Uganda Project. Herzl was in favor of that because of the pogroms that were going on in Kishinev, the idea did not fly. The British settlers there did not like it, and it caused a great stir in the Zionist movement. Sixth Zionist Congress saw the attendance of Vladimir Jabotinsky, who was enthralled by the idea of political Zionism and soon became a strong voice for Zionism in the Jewish community. 1904, Theodor Herzl died, burned out from all his efforts. Here's a picture of the funeral in Vienna. He instructed that his remains be taken to Israel as soon as the Jewish people founded a nation in Israel and that occurred in 1949. His remains were brought to Mount Herzl and reburied. The mountain, of course, named after him, and this is his final resting place as you would see it today. 1904 also saw the beginning of the Second Aliyah. Joseph Witkin issued a challenge, come as pioneers, and this challenge rang a bell, and many Jewish people came under the enthusiasm of being a pioneer. So in 1904 to 1914, there were four streams of Zionism active in the Zionist movement. The first stream was political Zionism, led by Herzl and his collaborators. Their emphasis was on politics, establishing the State of Israel through political means. Then there was religious Zionism, Mizrahi, that favored religious observance. Spiritual and cultural Zionism, led by Echad Ha'am, which focused on Jewish culture. And the latest newcomer to Zionism was labor Zionists, supported by the socialists, and their emphasis was on the economics that the new nation would need. Also, Ben-Gurion came into the country at that time as a young 19-year-old immigrant. HaShomer was instituted to start guarding the Jewish settlements. Tel Aviv was founded as a bedroom community to Jaffa. And Tel Aviv, of course, grew into the number one population center of Israel. Here is modern Tel Aviv today. All right, this brings us to the new material. We begin in 1914 and the beginning of World War I. By 1914, the Zionist movement had grown to 127,000 shekel-paying members. Zionist associations were functioning in South Africa and North and South America. Hebrew schools were being organized. Zionist literature was being translated into many languages. The little blue and white Jewish National Fund box could be found in growing thousands of Jewish homes and in hundreds of synagogues. The Jewish National Fund sponsored these little offering boxes, so coins were collected to buy and develop land in Israel. And that was very successful. In 1914, at the eve of World War I, practical Zionism, embracing both colonization in Israel and cultural activity in the diaspora, became a meaningful Jewish force worldwide. So two approaches were in operation, colonization and culture. In 1915, refugees from Israel formed the Zion Mule Corps. For all its impressive progress, the Yishuv itself remained the most vulnerable component of the Zionist movement after the outbreak of World War I. Up to that time, the Yishuv's Jews relied on European countries to ensure their physical security. And now, with Turkey's entrance into the war, that assurance was gone. The dangers of Turkish rule became all too apparent due to the increase of government brutality and expulsions. Jews throughout the Yishuv hurriedly began packing for departure. By March of 1915, some 10,000 had found asylum in Egypt. Half of them were lodged in the refugee camps of Gabari and Mafruza, where they were sustained by Jewish communal funds. It was among these refugees that the first efforts were launched to recruit a Jewish legion for battle service against the Turks. It was initiated by Vladimir Jabotinsky. He was that Russian Jewish journalist, and the appeal aroused a mixed response. But notable among those refugees was Joseph Trumpeldor, one of the most attractive and charismatic personalities in Zionist history. He was a handsome six-footer, and he originally had been trained as a dentist. But as a volunteer officer in the Russian army, he had lost an arm and had been decorated for heroism during the Russo-Japanese War. In more recent years, he'd been serving as a farmer pioneer on a kibbutzah in the Galilee. After the war began, Trumpeldor was one of those deported by the Turks. Immediately, he made his way to Alexandria, Egypt, to volunteer for the British Army. There he met Jabotinsky in the Mafruza camp, and the two promptly collaborated on the effort to recruit a Jewish legion. And here is a Yiddish Jewish legion World War I recruiting poster. The Yiddish says, Bat Zion, your old new land, of course that's a reference to Herzl's second book, your old new land must have you. Join the Jewish regiment. join and fight against the Turks. So while the British authorities in Egypt were not unresponsive to the notion, they preferred to limit it to a Jewish transport unit of service in an alternative Allied war theater. Well, despite Jabotinsky's initial misgivings, Trumpeldor favored the scheme. As long as the enemy was the Turk, he insisted, any front leads to Zion. Thus, in March and April of 1915, some 500 Jews were accepted for enlistment into a special transportation unit, the Zion Mule Corps, and allowed to wear their own shoulder flashes bearing the Shield of David. And here is the Jewish Legion Veteran ribbon for the Jewish Mule Corps, the Zion Mule Corps. Now, their assignment was the impending Dardanelles campaign. A British officer, Lieutenant Colonel John Patterson, was placed in charge of the force, but its animating spirit was Trumpeldor, now commissioned as a captain in the British Army. Upon disembarkation at the beaches of Gallipoli, the Zion Mule Corps performed credibly, the men leading their supply mules to the front trenches under heavy fire. And here is the area where they served. Gallipoli is in the Dardanelles. We'll focus in on the Dardanelles here, and this is the Gallipoli Peninsula where the British had their Gallipoli campaign. Now, 8 of the troops were killed, 55 others were wounded, among them was Trumpeldor. Another 150 young Jews from Egypt promptly volunteered as replacements. With the subsequent evacuation of Gallipoli in the winter of 1915, the Mule Corps was among the last units to be withdrawn. Its reputation by then had spread throughout the Zionist world. The Zion Mule Corps was dissolved once the Gallipoli campaign ended, but the episode of the Zion Mule Corps appeared to be, on the surface, just a short and unimpressive detail in the vast machinery of World War I. Unrecognized by British and the Jews alike, the episode of the Zion Mule Corps represented the first tentative steps in developing English Zionist collaboration. Now we move to 1916 and the Seitz-Picot Agreement. It was the outbreak of World War I that suddenly invested Palestine with new importance in Allied military calculations. From then on, England based its Near Eastern policy on a central immutable criterion, the security of the Suez Canal. Well, what's the importance of the Suez Canal? Well, here is planet Earth, and of course, here is the area where Israel and the Suez Canal are located. Well, let's go in for a little closer look at the Suez Canal. Here is the Suez Canal, located here between the Mediterranean Sea and the Red Sea. It connects these two body of waters through that short stretch of land. In closer, now here you can see the Suez Canal from space as it looks today. That long artificial canal running from the Mediterranean to the Red Sea. And here is the Suez Canal today. Here you see U.S. Navy warships traversing the canal, going from the Mediterranean to the Red Sea, or vice versa. So it's a very strategic location. You see, here is England. Here is England on the globe. And way over here on the other side of the globe is England's colony in India. The British Empire stretched around the world. Now, if you wanted to go from England to India, you would have to send your ships all the way around the bulk of the continent of Africa, a long and arduous trip around the Horn to the far south and then over to India. It was a long, long trip. Now, if you had the Suez Canal in place, the trip would be tremendously reduced because you could now take a shortcut through the Mediterranean, into the Red Sea, and then over to India. And so the canal had a tremendous strategic worth in cutting the transportation distance and facilitating communication between England and its far-flung colonies. So it was a very, very important and strategic asset that the British owned. So to cope with any threat to the canal, military headquarters in Cairo devoted increasing attention to a new political strategy. It was to mobilize the Ottoman Empire's restless subject peoples in a joint military effort against the Turks. In fact, the idea initially had been suggested by a distinguished Arab personality, the Emir Abdullah, the eldest son of Hussein, the Hashemite Sharif of Mecca and Medina. Even before the war, Abdullah had visited General Kitchener in Cairo to request British help in protecting his father's dynasty against the suspicious Ottoman overlords. In return for British support, it was understood that the Hashemite Arabs would join the Allied war effort against Turkey. Moreover, after the war, the newly established Arab government would seek the advice and guidance of Great Britain only. So on the basis of this, the Arab revolt finally began in June of 1916 under the leadership of Hussein's second son, the Emir Faisal, and later with the help of such British liaison officers as T.E. Lawrence. And of course, here is T.E. Lawrence, the very famous Lawrence of Arabia. Here is another portrait of Colonel Lawrence by Lowell Thomas, the journalist. And a very nice painting of T.E. Lawrence by Augustus John. And I also have included this portrait of the Emir Faisal, again by Augustus John. During the subsequent year and a half, the uprising between 10,000 and 20,000 Arab irregulars played a major part in the British military effort against Turkish forces in Arabia and eastern Palestine. Britain had informed the French and Russian governments of the agreement with Sharif Hussein. It was in January of 1916 that Sir Mark Sykes, and here's, of course, Officer Sykes, the British representative, and Charles Francois Georges Picot, the French emissary, reached a meeting of minds on the allocation of the post-war spheres of influence in the Arab world. And, of course, here is Sir Mark Sykes, and here is a drawing of Charles Francois Georges Picot. Britain would be invested with supervision over Arab territories encompassing the largest part of Mesopotamia, most of Transjordan, and southern Palestine. The French would exercise various degrees of influence over southern Turkey, Syria, northern Palestine, and the Mosul area of upper Mesopotamia. And here is a detail of the Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916. The red area is the area of British control. The blue area is the area of French control. Green area is the Russian control. And then there's an international zone here in Israel. And here's a close-up of that international zone. Again, British control in the red, French control in the blue, and then British, France, and Russia shared control in the international zone. Do you see a state of Palestine there? No, you don't see a state of Palestine there either. It never existed. Militarily, Sinai and Palestine began to function increasingly as British chosen battlefield against the Turks. The Sinai Peninsula offered a more direct and manageable invasion route toward the Ottoman countries. Once this plan of action was agreed upon, the Imperial General Command in June of 1916, British military headquarters in Cairo set about organizing and equipping a 150,000-man Egyptian expeditionary force in anticipation for a straight-line plunge into Palestine. The force was commanded by General Sir Edmund Allenby. In 1917, we also had the Balfour Declaration. So let's see how events led up to the Balfour Declaration. But at this time, as World War I progressed, Zionism had become well known among some British politicians and statesmen. In fact, at the Fourth Zionist Congress in 1900, that Congress had been held in London and received considerable publicity. So Anglo-Zionism was faring fairly well in England during 1914 and at the start of World War I. So one reason was the quality of the Zionist activities. One reason for the quality of these Zionist activities lay in the character of the Zionists living in England at that time. Their acknowledged spokesman was Dr. Chaim Weizmann, a 40-year-old chemistry instructor at the University of Manchester. And here's a portrait of Chaim Weizmann. In March of 1916, Weizmann was summoned to London to help solve the shortage of acetone, an ingredient in the naval explosive cordite. After 2 years of laboratory research, he accomplished the task by devising a special fermentation process. So during that period of time, the friendships Weizmann made at the highest levels of British government were cemented very firmly. Weizmann's efforts as a Zionist were further strengthened by other advantages. One was the mystical veneration with which many devout Anglo-Saxon Protestants regarded the Old Testament traditions, the children of Israel, and particularly the land of Israel itself. And two of these devout men were Lloyd George and James Arthur Balfour. And here is a portrait of David Lloyd George. These men possessed a lifelong interest in the Holy Land and in its traditions. And these men felt deeply Christianity's historic obligations to the Jews. That debt was compounded by Weizmann's personal services in the Allied war effort. Against this background of Anglo-Zionist cordiality, Weizmann's allusions to a British protectorate over a Jewish homeland struck an increasing responsive chord among government officials. The moment of decisive reappraisal in Middle Eastern policy came in the last weeks of 1916, when Lloyd George and Balfour became Prime Minister and Foreign Minister, respectively. The new government recognized that the Sykes-Picot Agreement was not an airtight guarantee for British interests in Palestine. Perhaps then the Jews, as a client people, might be useful in opening a wedge for British domination, as were the Arabs. Now, Sykes was the official who served as the marriage broker in the progressively intimate relationship between the British government and the Zionist leadership. Sykes met with Weizmann on October 7, 1917. By then, it had become Sykes' mission to wed Zionist and British interests. Now, Balfour. Let's take a look at Arthur Balfour. Now, Balfour had been nurtured in the Old Testament, and his extensive study of Jewish history had filled him with inner remorse about Christendom's treatment of the Jews. He told Harold Nicholson in 1917, "They have been exiled, scattered, and oppressed. If we can find them an asylum, a safe home in their native land, then the full flowering of their genius will burst forth and propagate." Now, imperial self-interest obviously was paramount in the government's calculations. Yet in Balfour's case, a genuine vein of biblical influence unquestionably strengthened commitment to the Jewish national home. On June 17, 1917, Balfour urged the Zionists themselves to formulate an appropriate declaration. He would submit it to the War Cabinet with his endorsement. Weizmann and his closest associates immediately prepared such a statement, and it was submitted on July 18, 1917. The declaration originally read, "His Majesty's government accepts the principle that Palestine should be reconstituted as a national home for the Jewish people. His Majesty's government will use its best endeavors to secure achievement of this object and will discuss the necessary method and means with the Zionist organization." Ironically, the only forceful opposition came from the one Jewish man in the Lloyd George government, Edwin Montague. Montague's opposition had the effect of not changing the minds of Balfour, George, and other Zionist sympathizers, but in persuading them to create a milder version of the text. So the declaration was reworded and approved by the War Cabinet on October 31, 1917, and the declaration now read, "His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country." And so here's the original letter of the Balfour Declaration that was sent to the Zionists. And if you're interested in reading more about the Balfour Declaration, this is a very interesting book to pick up, The Balfour Declaration by Jonathan Schneer. Now, Lady Dugdale, Balfour's niece, wrote, "Near the end of his days, he said to me that on the whole, he felt that what he had been able to do for the Jews had been the thing he looked back upon as the most worth doing. Thank you, Lord, for Arthur Balfour. Balfour told a friend in 1918, "My personal hope is that the Jews will make good in Palestine and eventually found a Jewish state." And his personal hope has been realized, hasn't it? In the same year, Lord Robert Cecil declared, "Our wish is that the Arabian country shall be for the Arabs, Armenia for the Armenians, and Judea for the Jews." Now, in 1920, Churchill, who had served as a minister of munitions when the Balfour Declaration was issued, spoke of a Jewish state by the banks of the Jordan, which might comprise 3 or 4 million Jews. Well, Winston, you missed it. You missed it by 100%. Israel now consists of something like 6 million Jewish people. In 1919, Mr. Smuts, also a former member of the War Cabinet, envisioned the rise of a great Jewish state. Now, Prime Minister Lloyd George was quite explicit in his description of the Cabinet's proposal. "It was contemplated that when the time arrived for according representative institutions in Palestine, if the Jews had meanwhile responded to the opportunity afforded them by the idea of a national home and had become a definite majority of the inhabitants, then Palestine would thus become a Jewish commonwealth. The notion that Jewish immigration would have been artificially restricted in order to ensure that the Jews should be a permanent minority never entered the heads of anyone engaged in framing the policy. That would have been regarded as unjust and as a fraud on the people to whom we were appealing." And there's one more quote here I'd like to share with you. This is not in your notes. This is from the Jewish Virtual Library, just a quotation on Zionism. A member of the House of Lords asked Chaim Weizmann, "Why do you Jews insist on Palestine when there are so many undeveloped countries you could settle in more conveniently? You know, there's Uganda, there's Al-Rish, there's Cyprus, you know. Why don't you go to some place like that where it's easy, you could easily settle in those countries and make a home for yourself?" Weizmann answered, "That's like my asking you why you drove 20 miles to visit your mother last Sunday when there were so many old ladies living on your street. Why couldn't you just go visit one of those old ladies, you know?" But it was your mother who you wanted to visit, so you made the effort, didn't you? I said, "Mr. Balfour, if you were offered Paris instead of London, would you take it?" He looked surprised. He said, "But London is our own." I said, "Jerusalem was our own when London was a marsh." He said, "That's true. That's true." Well, the Jews in England were thrilled and grateful. When news of the declaration reached Russia, it evoked wild rejoicing. Petitions and cables of gratitude flooded in on Balfour from Jewish communities as far away as Shanghai, Alexandria, and Cape Town. If the War Cabinet's major objective was to swing neutral Jewish opinion toward Britain, it succeeded beyond all expectations. However, it's interesting to note that currently there are attacks against the Balfour Declaration. It is being attacked these days. For example, this article came out in 2013. It's a little dated. It seems like these attacks have abated, but here were the attacks in 2013. British Christians denounced the Balfour Declaration, claiming it's one of the greatest mistakes in history. The document that was launched Sunday in Britain announced that the Balfour Declaration is a mistake and that has betrayed the Palestinian people. It says it's one of the greatest mistakes in our imperial history. Well, so far the Balfour Declaration has not been rescinded in any way. All right, now we come to the British capture of Jerusalem. It was in October of 1970 that Allenby launched the invasion of Palestine. And again, here is Field Marshal Edmund Allenby. The initial phase of the campaign was successful beyond the general's highest expectations. Augmented by tens of thousands of Commonwealth troops, the Egyptian Expeditionary Force struck quickly in the interior of the country, overrunning Beersheba, capturing Jaffa on November 16th, and finally taking Jerusalem 3 weeks later. And here is the route of the Egyptian Expeditionary Force. First to Beersheba, taking Beersheba, then north to the coast, taking Jaffa, and then inland 3 weeks later, securing Jerusalem. And here is a picture of Allenby entering Jerusalem on December 11, 1917. Allenby himself marched on foot into the historic capital to address a gathering of Muslim, Christian, and Jewish notables which had been convened on the steps of the Tower of David. "We have come as conquerors," he said. We have come not as conquerors. I got it right. Sorry, General Allenby. "We have come not as conquerors, but as deliverers. It is our intention to open a new era of brotherhood and peace in the Holy Land." It was the anniversary of Hanukkah, the commemoration of the Maccabean triumph that had liberated ancient Israel and opened a renewed era of Jewish national glory in 165 BC. But now, in December of 1917, as menorah candles gleamed in Jerusalem and in Jewish homes around the world, observant Jews everywhere uttered prayers of gratitude for this astonishing coincidence. In 1918, World War I came to an end. Ultimately, when the British finally overran the last of the enemy's forces in September of 1918, the Jewish population had been reduced from its pre-war figure of 85,000 to less than 55,000. The country had been starved by Allied blockade, ravaged and ruined by Turkish forces. Scores of villages had been laid waste, trees and orange groves damaged, public security all but extinguished. The British naturally gave their first and most urgent attention to food supplies, which Allenby ordered imported directly from Egypt. The American Near East Relief soon followed with shipments of clothing and medicines for the Christian and Muslim populations. The Zionist organization and Hadassah, its women's counterpart, matched these efforts for the Jewish community. Now, at this point, I'd like to take a little excursus and talk about the biblical importance of World War I. Let's begin in Matthew 23, verses 3 and verses 7 and 8, because World War I is the sign of the end of the age. Here's what we read in Matthew 24, verse 3. "As he," as Yeshua, as Jesus, "was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, 'Tell us, when will these things happen? And what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age?'" So that's the specific question. What is the sign of the end of the age? And we move to verse 7. "The sign of the end of the age: for nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and in various places there will be famines and earthquakes. But all these things are merely the beginning of the birth pangs." Birth pangs. So this statement, nation against nation and kingdom against kingdom, are Jewish figures of speech during the first century for a world war. And the term birth pang is a biblical figure of speech for the end days. So the answer to the question, when you see a world war, that's the sign of the end of the age. So World War I marked the beginning of the birth pangs, the beginning of the end of the age. We have been in the last days since 1914. So for more details on this, I would direct you to the book Footsteps of the Messiah by Dr. Arnold Fruchtenbaum. It is a study of eschatology, the sequence of events, and the book of Revelation. All right, the Zionist Commission is appointed. In December of 1917, the British Foreign Secretary had approved the departure of a Zionist commission for Palestine to organize relief work and supervise repair of damage done to the Jewish colonies. The commission embarked for Israel on March of 1918. It was eventually given the official status as an advisory body to the military government in all matters relating to the Jewish community. At this point in time, no one raised any objections to a Jewish national home in Israel. Nobody did. Everybody was supportive of it. Now, France rejected British and Zionist claims to the headwaters of the Jordan, but the French Prime Minister did not dream of challenging the notion of a Jewish national home. Neither did the Italian government. And, of course, there was no Palestinian government of any sort. President Wilson remained firmly committed to the Balfour Declaration throughout the peace conference. He stated to Felix Frankfurter, this is President Wilson. He made a comment to Felix Frankfurter, a leading American Zionist. President Wilson said, And so far I have found no one. So far I have found no one who is seriously opposing the purpose for which it, the Balfour Declaration, embodies. No one was opposing the Balfour Declaration at that time. When entrusting Palestine to Britain, the Allied statesmen at the San Remo Peace Conference incorporated into their allocation award the verbatim text of the Balfour Declaration. So the San Remo Peace Conference included the entire Balfour Declaration in their mandate to Britain. So the basic moral support of the Western governments appeared firmly established as a result. For a while, too, the friendship of the Hashemite Arab leadership seemed equally beyond question. In January of 1918, after the Balfour Declaration was issued, Commander D.H. Hogarth, the research director of the Arab Bureau in Cairo, was dispatched to Arabia to clarify for Hussein the implications of the Zionist program. Sensing the potential financial advantages of Arab-Jewish cooperation, Hussein was enthusiastic. The Sharif issued the Jews several warmly phrased invitations to return to their sacred and beloved homeland, quote, their sacred and beloved homeland. At the end of the year, December of 1918, Sykes brought Weizmann and Faisal together in London. Each expressed mutual understanding and support for each other's position. The discussions and courtesies between them were ultimately formalized in a document signed by both Weizmann and Faisal. It was a pact envisioning a common stance at the peace conference. It declared, His Royal Highness, the Emir Faisal, representing and acting on behalf of the Arab Kingdom of Hejaz, and Dr. Chaim Weizmann, representing and acting on behalf of the Zionist organization, mindful of the racial kinship and ancient bonds existing between the Arabs and the Jewish people, and realizing that the surest means of working out the consummation of their national aspirations is through the closest possible cooperation in the development of the Arab state and Palestine, and being desirous further of confirming the good understanding which exists between them, have agreed on the following articles. And nine articles comprise the agreement. And here is a picture of Weizmann and Faisal together. And here again, another picture of the Emir. Here is Lawrence of Arabia. And this is the Faisal-Weizmann agreement, showing the signatures of Weizmann and Faisal and the translation of some comments by Faisal, translated by D.H. Lawrence, by Lawrence of Arabia. So this treaty was signed in January 4th, 1919. It turned out, however, that Faisal expected Zionist diplomatic support against the French. It soon became evident that Weizmann was unwilling to act independently of his British patrons. So by mid-1919, as a result, Faisal terminated his public meetings with the Zionists. His January 4th treaty with Weizmann was not published, and the Zionists, respecting Faisal's wishes, withheld comment on it for many years. Increasingly disillusioned with the Zionist connection, the Emir chose now to envision the Jewish national home as merely a sub-province within the Arab kingdom. He said, when some Zionists speak about Palestine becoming as Jewish as England, as England is English, they are really talking unreasonably. In late autumn of 1919, Faisal ceased public communication with the Zionist leadership altogether. His policy of invoking Jewish cooperation for Arab diplomatic purposes in Syria had failed. Now we come to 1919 and the Third Aliyah. Pogroms were prevalent in the Ukraine and in Poland. There was abolishment of community organization and Jewish institutions in Russia. Although the population of the Yishuv had fallen to 55,000 at the end of World War I, the numbers were replenished almost immediately in 1919. This influx became known as the Third Aliyah. Jews poured in from Eastern Europe at the rate of 1,000 a month. by 1920 and ultimately reached a total of 37,000 newcomers between 1919 and 1923. Most of the immigrants were simultaneously fleeing revolution, counter-revolutionary pogroms, and civil wars. Many came under the illusion that a Jewish state was about to be established. All of them, in any case, regarded post-war Eastern Europe as a dead end. The Russian Revolution of March 1917 and the overthrow of the Tsarist regime initially ended all Jewish disabilities and removed the shackles on Zionist activity in Russia, and even led briefly to an unprecedented burst of Russian Zionist enthusiasm and growth. By early autumn, the movement embraced some 1,200 local groups and a membership of 300,000. 1917 was Russian Zionism's golden opportunity. However, it was cut short by the Bolshevik Revolution in November of that year. The new communist regime, in its early stages, placed few limitations on Zionist activities. Palestinian immigration bureaus at first functioned without interference in major cities, and during 1918, some 4,000 Jewish people managed to depart Russia for Palestine. In December, however, the Jewish section of the Communist Party began to denounce the counter-revolutionary essence of Zionism. And in February 1919, Zionist offices were closed and Zionist periodicals banned. Soon, a full-scale anti-Zionist crusade was unleashed in the Ukraine and other Jewish centers. And by 1923, Zionist organizational activity had all but expired in Russia. Hechalutz. Despite the Bolshevik repression, an unusually effective Zionist immigration organization sprang up at this time. It was allowed to function in Russia during the early 1920s. It was known as Hechalutz, the Pioneer. The organization's formal training program in Russia infused the Third Aliyah with a practical dynamic unique to the Zionist history. Their unique emphasis was pre-immigration agricultural training. The notion of advanced agricultural experience was first promoted widely by Joseph Trumpeldor. Remember Joseph Trumpeldor? He returned to Russia in February of 1917. At the outset, his intention was to recruit a Jewish legion for the liberation of Palestine. In the following year, when the Bolshevik revelation aborted the plan, Trumpeldor immediately issued another call to his admirers. He stated, "We cannot be an army, so let us be pioneers. Let us sow the seeds a handful at a time until we conquer the land of Israel." So let's conquer the land plot by plot, garden by garden, farm by farm. Now, Trumpeldor warned his listeners that it was not simply enough to depart for Palestine and become workers or farmers. The pioneers of the Second Aliyah had followed this course of action and thought they would build a utopian society by sheer force of tenacity and willpower, but they had failed. So Trumpeldor insisted and urged Jewish youth to equip themselves in advance for the tasks ahead. They must train while still in Russia, cultivate the soil adjacent to their villages, learn from the farmers all about them. And in the end, he himself and a number of close associates traveled throughout Western Russia, organizing Hechalutz groups and establishing training centers in Minsk and Simferopol. Minsk is in Belarus. Here's a map of the area. Here's Belarus. Minsk is in Belarus. And to the south on the Black Sea is Crimea. And Simferopol is in Crimea. Tens of thousands of Jewish young men and women joined the organization during the summer and autumn months of 1918. Enthusiastically, they took up the study of agriculture or purchased or rented tracts of land, closely following the advice of Jewish and occasional Russian instructors. Now, the Bolsheviks tolerated this activity for purely functional reasons. It attracted badly needed American Jewish philanthropic funds. In 1921, a World Hechalutz organization was founded, and here's the Hechalutz insignia. And this is a membership card in the Hechalutz organization. By 1925, Hechalutz membership had reached 33,000, and by 1933, 83,000. As early as 1919, however, the first Hechalutz youngsters began arriving in Israel. 1920, the British are granted the mandate over Israel. Rarely had the fruits of military victory been as palpable as those savored by England when the fighting stopped. By December 1918, 200,000 Commonwealth troops had planted the Union Jack in Syria, Western Turkey, Palestine, Mesopotamia, and Lower Iran. It was a swath of territory encompassing all the historic land routes between the Mediterranean and the Indian Ocean. And Palestine would be awarded to the British as the British mandate. Now, here's the area allocated for a Jewish national home at the San Remo Conference in 1920. Notice the full extent of Palestine, the British mandate. Now, what is a mandate or the mandate? This is from dictionary.com. The mandate in the League of Nations is a commission given to a nation to administer the government and affairs of a former Turkish territory, which would be the Ottoman Empire, or German colony. The purpose was to prepare and eventually release that territory for independent statehood. So the Supreme Council of the Peace Conference, formally validated this understanding at San Remo, Italy, in April 25, 1920. On the basis of exhausted geographic and geological surveys, Weizmann and his Zionist colleagues asked the Supreme Council for a Palestine bounded on the north by the slopes of the Lebanon Range, the headquarters of the Jordan, and the crest of Mount Hermon, on the east by the Transjordan Mesopotamian Desert, and on the south by the Gulf of Aqaba. So here is the mandate for the Jewish national home given to Britain. And the Zionists examined the territory and they said, well, we don't want all of that. We would just like the north slopes of the Lebanon Range and the headwaters of the Jordan, crest of Mount Hermon, that's all to the north there. In the east, the Transjordan Mesopotamian Desert, and the south, just bring us down to the Gulf of Aqaba. That's the area we would prefer. We don't need all the area set aside for a Jewish home. Now, the French were not prepared to accept these boundaries. On December 4, 1920, the British and French prime ministers reached a final understanding on the boundary issue, and the accord represented a painful setback for the Jews. This is Great Britain's division of the mandated area, 1921 to 1923. To the north and northeast, the country was deprived of its most important potential water sources, including the Litani River, a key headwater to the Jordan, the spring coming out from Mount Hermon, and a greater part of the Yarmouk River. The boundary similarly ignored the historic entity of Palestine as envisioned in the original negotiations leading to the Balfour Declaration. Moreover, in failing to approximate any natural geographic frontiers, the borders left the country perennially exposed to armed invasion. The heritage of economic and military vulnerability was to curse the Palestine Mandate and later the entire Middle East for decades to come. This was a big mistake, this division of the mandated area. So we'll talk about more details about this division in the times to come. Tel Chai. In August of 1919, Joseph Trumpeldor returned to Israel to arrange facilities for the expected influx of Chalutzim, pioneers. He lived on his kibbutz Tel Chai in the Galilee. You can see from the square on the left, where the up in northern Israel, and there's Tel Chai way up in the panhandle of the Galilee, up there near Lebanon. However, in 1919, fear and distrust of Zionist aims grew daily among the Arabs. Barbed Arab newspaper editorials began to appear. Public Arab threats and instances of unrest in Arab towns grew month by month. In February of 1920, a party of Arab raiders attacked the Jewish colonies of Matula and Tel Chai along Israel's northern border. These settlements were located in a gray area between British and French zones of occupation. Among those killed defending the outposts was Joseph Trumpeldor. And this is the Trumpeldor Memorial at Tel Chai, the Defiant Lion. And here are his last words. This is Trumpeldor's famous, but it is disputed, last words. Never mind, it is good to die for our country. Well, that led to Arab riots in Jerusalem. Ominously, it was the season of Nevi Musa, the season of the prophet Moses, which is a traditional Arab counterpart to Easter and Passover, when devout Muslims travel in pilgrimage on the Jericho road to the grave of Moses. Of course, this is unbiblical because Deuteronomy 34:6 says that the gravesite of Moses is unknown. So this is just a tradition. The Arabs arrived in Jerusalem on April 4, 1920. Soon a large crowd gathered to hear a nationalist harangue by agitators. Not all of the people were local, who extolled the name of Faisal. Their purpose was to clearly influence the Allies, who were scheduled to assign the mandates in San Remo within the next few days. The crowd became unruly, the Arab police joined in the applause, and violence began. During the next 3 hours, 160 Jews were wounded. Eventually, British troops arrived and quelled the disturbances. The next morning, however, instigators who had been detained overnight were released and the attacks on the Jews promptly resumed. Order was not restored until the third day. The number of Jews and Arabs had been killed by then and several hundred wounded. And now we come to Sir Herbert Samuel, the High Commissioner. It was in San Remo, a day before the assignment of the mandates, that Herbert Samuel was informed of his selection by Lloyd George as Civil High Commissioner to Palestine. Here is Sir Herbert Samuel. And the next slide is his arrival in Palestine. Here is Lawrence of Arabia, T.E. Lawrence. Here is the Emir Abdullah. And here is Sir Herbert Samuel. He was known as a loyal Jew and a Zionist. This reputation seemingly emphasized the government's commitment to a Jewish national home. The appointment obviously was not without its risks. Faisal regarded it as a provocation to the Arabs. So did Allenby, who warned that violence would follow. Samuel arrived in Jerusalem on June 30th under tight security. The misgivings and precautions soon appeared unwarranted. Most of Samuel's initial appointments aroused enthusiasm among Jews and Arabs alike. The Zionists were particularly gratified by Samuel's firm open-door policy on immigration. Remember, the Balfour Declaration did not restrict immigration in any way, shape, or form. Even Arab nationalists respected Samuel. However, this very impartiality proved to be the High Commissioner's Achilles heel. It was his obsession with fairness that influenced him to make conciliatory gestures to the Arabs, and far from satisfying Arab nationalism, these gestures encouraged it. So Arab restlessness throughout Palestine grew. So it's okay to establish Arab states in the area, but not Jewish states. Now this map comes from the Atlas of the Arab-Israeli Conflict by Martin Gilbert. On the page dealing with Arab nationalism, we will read this block. Largely as a result of Britain's victories over the Turks in 1917 and 1918, more than 10 million Arabs were liberated from Turkish rule. 10 million Arabs liberated. The total area of Arab lands in Arabia was 1,184,000 square miles. Palestine, the only portion of former Turkish territory set aside for the Jewish national home, covered less than 11,000 square miles, approximately 1% of that area. So, Arab nationalism in 1917 to 1971, these are the states that the British either freed or created out of the Ottoman Empire. Egypt, Transjordan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Aden, Oman, Muscat, the Trucial States, Qatar, Kuwait, Iraq, and Syria. So it's great to establish all these Arab states, but not Israel, but not a Jewish state. And here is the Arab world today. Here is this little tiny country of Israel. Balfour stated, "So as far as the Arabs were concerned, I hope they will remember that it is we who have established an Arab independent sovereignty in the Hejaz." That's the Western Arabian Peninsula. The British did it. "I hope that they will remember it is we who desire in Mesopotamia to prepare the way for the future of self-governing autonomous Arab state." You know, that's our aim. "And I hope that, remembering all that, they will not grudge that small notch, for it is no more than that geographically, whatever it may be historically, that small notch in what are now Arab territories being given to the people for all these hundreds of years have been separated from it." Arthur J. Balfour, July 20th, 1920. And there's the tiny, small notch that is Israel. And look at the Arab world today. The Arab world today is huge. Well, let's move on. Weizmann is elected the president of the Zionist organization. The Zionist organization was in some disarray following World War I. Its political machinery had ceased to function during the 4.5 years of hostilities. The central Zionist offices had remained in Germany, the bulk of its membership in Russia. Now, Weizmann's stupendous coup in achieving the Balfour Declaration transformed London into the operative political headquarters of Zionism. It was Weizmann and his associates who convened a special conference of Zionist leaders in London in July of 1920. The London conference took upon itself to elect Weizmann president of the Zionist organization. Karen HaYesud established. At the London conference, Weizmann emphasized the priority need in building a Jewish national home. The priority need was knowledge, modern methods, and money. For the purpose of gathering all-important money, Weizmann and his colleagues on the Zionist Executive Committee authorized the establishment of Karen HaYesud, a foundation fund to tap the resources of diaspora Jewry. And Karen HaYesud still exists today. Here is their website. It's also known as the United Jewish Appeal. The Histadrut was founded. In 1920, the Jewish Labor Federation of Palestine, or Histadrut, was founded. The essential post-war emphasis for the Histadrut was supplied by two political factions, Achdut HaAvuda and HaPoel HaZair. Achdut HaAvuda means the Union of Labor. HaPoel HaZair means the Young Worker. The two labor groups submerged their differences and tried to create an apolitical or non-political, purely labor federation. On that basis, the Histadrut was founded in Haifa in December of 1920. It was significant that a majority of the Histadrut's early members belonged to kibbutzim and moshavim, and the federation placed its heaviest emphasis on creating work opportunities for Jews in the land. Now, what is a kibbutz? A kibbutz in Hebrew is a gathering or a clustering. Plural is kibbutzim. A kibbutz is a collective community in Israel that was traditionally based on agriculture. A moshav is slightly different. Moshavim is plural. The word means settlement or village. It's a type of Israeli town or settlement, in particular, a type of cooperative agricultural community of individual farms. So a kibbutz, there's no individuality. Everything belongs to all the members. But in a moshav, all the farms are independent. They belong to the farmer, but they share certain tools and important resources. That's the difference between a kibbutz and a moshav. The Histadrut began to organize strikes, against planters who refused to give work priorities to Jews. And not infrequently, pickets were used to use strong-arm tactics to induce Arab workers to return to their homes. So they intimidated the cheap Arab labor. With the bulk of Jewish manpower pouring into the cities, the Histadrut increasingly turned its attention to the urban areas. It organized unions, not simply among manual laborers, but among clerks and technicians, and even doctors and lawyers. In 1923, the Histadrut established a central economic corporation, the Chevrat Ovdim, the Workers' Association, and functioned as a cooperative wholesale society to buy the products from the kibbutzim and the moshavim, and in turn, through its chain of retail stores, to sell the farm villages' foodstuffs, clothing, and industrial goods. In 1926, the Chevrat Ovdim organized a marketing outlet Tenuva for kibbutz and moshav dairy products. Then a workers' bank, the Bank HaPoalim, as its major credit instrument for the farm settlements and the labor enterprises in the cities. And these still exist today. Here's the Tenuva website for dairy products in Israel. And here is the Bank HaPoalim website for this for the bank. The Hevrat's housing company, the Shikun, provided workers with flats at the lowest nonprofit rentals. The Histadrut forestalled the worst of the issue's economic inequalities and minimized cutthroat competition. The Histadrut's most important innovation, undoubtedly, was its program of universal medical coverage, known as the Chupat Olim, the sick fund. It was launched as far back as 1911, with some 2,000 participants in the eve of the war. By 1930, its membership had climbed to 15,000, a number that would double to 30,000 by 1935. The Histadrut formed a school network in 1921. By 1934, 135 Histadrut schools represented 44% of all the schools in the Hebrew educational system. By 1925, the Histadrut founded its own dramatic company, Ohel, and began publishing its own newspaper, Davar. Its Workers' Federation also launched a number of its own industrial companies. The most important of these industrial firms was the Solel Bonet, the paving and building company. The company drained swamps in the Jezreel and Hula valleys. They built roads, erected housings and office buildings, and in the progress opened up thousands of new job opportunities. And here's a building, a modern building built by the Solel Bonet. That's what the Hebrew word means there, Solel Bonet construction here. As early as 1930, the multitude of these activities drew into the Histadrut three-quarters of the Jewish working population in Palestine. Nearly all phases of a man's life and the life of his family were embraced by the vast canopy of the workers' organization. By the eve of World War II, the Histadrut had become much more than a powerful institution in Jewish Palestine. For the majority of the Yishuv, the Histadrut was all but synonymous with Jewish Palestine itself. Well, I see I'm a little bit over time, and so let's call it quits right here. We'll pick it up next session with the founding of the Haganah. We'll see the beginning of the Jewish defense system. So, thanks so much for being our students. We'll see you next session. Lehitra'ot.